The death of Rebecca Zihu is one of the most popular deaths to explore in the true crime community. That's because it's filled with so many unanswered questions, yet there's also so many potential answers, which require only a small leap in logic. Mix in an unlikable suspect, and this is a case that can drive someone crazy. Today we're going to jump into these waters and see if perhaps we can bring any clarity to this bizarre situation.
Killing, missing, hidden. The podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Killing, Missing, Hidden Podcast, the podcast to the stars. And you, my lovely listeners, are my stars. This is your old buddy Bad, trying to add some legal analysis to some of the crazy true crime cases throughout the world. As promised, this week we are bringing you one of the more bizarre death cases I've read about. No doubt that those of you committed to true crime podcasts and YouTubers and whatnot have heard about this case probably multiple times. I hope I can put at least somewhat of a unique spin on it for you. Before we begin, I'm happy to report our Instagrams back up, so if you aren't following us, please do. The more followers we have, the more powerful we will become on that platform. And fortunately, it doesn't follow Highlander rules, so it's not like we have to kill anybody to gain more power. It's just, you know, more of an ego boost. Also, we've got our Facebook group. You may want to join before February, because I plan on doing some little special contest, giveaway, whatnot, just for the members of our Facebook group. And you'll probably want to be in on it. I'm not going to give away what we plan on giving away. That was poorly worded. I need better writers. But let's just say that it may rhyme with rap chance. Want a little rap chance, you know, from Brad? Yeah. All right, no more waste. This is a long episode. Here we go. Prepare your earballs. Rebecca Zihu's family was born in Burma, or Myanmar as it's known today. Her father was known as a political activist, and that really didn't go over well under a military dictatorship. So her dad made the smart choice to move and to leave Burma for safer territory. Family bounced around a bit. They lived in India for a spell, then Nepal, and eventually ended up in the good old US of A by way of Missouri specifically. You know, they came from poverty. They lived a very meager lifestyle, but their dad, you know, he did a lot, and he was able to make sure that when they settled the United States, his daughters had every opportunity in the world to succeed. Like, literally, when they were in Burma, they were living in this, like, three-room shack. All of his girls had to share a bed. But Mr. Zihu did his job as a dad and gave his daughters a better life. And to that effect, Rebecca was excited to get out and kind of make her own life. So she didn't hang around the Show Me State for very long. She ended up moving to Arizona to take a job in an eye clinic. It kind of sounds like Rebecca moved to Arizona, maybe on a bit of a whim. But when she started working at the eye clinic, she realized that she really dug it. Like, it was really for her. So much so that she even decided to go to school and become an ophthalmic technician. Because she thought, you know, this could be my career. And she did, and she loved it. She worked there for a while. She was the sort that loved helping people in whatever fashion. And then she was struck by love from another cord. The type of love that can only be found while peering through an odd-looking metal mask with rotating pieces of glass into the eyes of a stranger, I suppose. A fellow by the name of Jonah Shatney had come into the clinic for a routine eye exam, not expecting to receive treatment for his broken heart. Now, a few of y'all may recognize his name. He's the founder of Medicis Pharmaceuticals, which is a major player in the world of medical cosmetics. They're best known for making Restylane, which apparently is the primary alternative for Botox, and other things along this line. But, you know, needless to say, he's mega, mega rich. But sincerely, that didn't seem to interest Rebecca at all. Like, when she talked to her family about Jonah, or her, when she talked to her friends, and even when, like, she introduced Jonah to her family and to her friends for the first few times, like, she never really mentioned what he did for a living. It was all about how well they got along, what a good guy he was, that sort of stuff. And I'm sure the money was cool, but Rebecca doesn't really come across as a materialistic person. In fact, while she was working as the eye technician, every month she would send her parents whatever she could, and typically around $400 a month, just to help them out. You know, good daughter right there. Really hope my boys are listening to this episode. Maybe grasp onto that philosophy, right, kids? I mean, remember who bought you all those video games and action figures. Okay, so personality-wise, Rebecca was a sort that was really into health and fitness and outdoor activities. She was this kind that kind of took challenges, you know, almost personally and would strive to overcome them. So if you said, you know, oh, that hill is too steep for you to climb, next thing you know, she'd be taking a selfie at the top of the hill. Or, you know, if you said, I bet you can't make me a club sandwich, you'd be holding a plate in your hand in no time. Rebecca was also kind of an amateur artist. It was her release. She loved to paint and just be creative in general. Jonah, meanwhile, kind of shared the same loves. He was really into the outdoors. He was really into fitness. And, you know, that interest in fitness probably allowed the relationship to work in part because he was like 20-something years older than her. So he had to really keep up. You know, if I weren't married, the only way I could get someone who was that much younger than me to be the slightest bit interested in me is probably if I was back in the hospital with COVID. Now, Jonah, too, kind of had a mistress, and that was his job. I mean, he loved to work. He built that company into what it was, and, you know, like most powerful, successful men who build up a company, they kind of, it's kind of their baby, and they want to take care of it. So he did spend a lot of time working. Now, both had a history of prior relationships that didn't really work out. Rebecca was previously married. Well, that's really not fair. She met Jonah in 2008 and officially started dating him in 2009, but she didn't divorce her husband until 2011. A little bit odd there. Jonah was twice divorced, most recently to Dina, with whom he had a child, little Max, who is all of six during our tale. He had children from a first marriage. They really aren't too involved in this story, so we'll kind of skip over that part of his life. Jonah lived in Phoenix, and, you know, that's where the company's headquarters was located. And obviously that's the only way he would have met Rebecca. But he had a summer house in Coronado, California. And apparently, I don't know, because I don't run in these circles, but apparently Coronado is a place where, like, only the rich of the rich can live. It's south of San Diego, and it's this town that's built kind of on these cliffs that face the Pacific Ocean. So it's one of these areas where there's really not a ton of, like, usable real estate, but everybody wants to be there. Now, Jonah apparently had the mansion of mansions in the area, this 27-room beauty that had a name. It was called the Spreckles Mansion, named after everybody's favorite industrialist, John Spreckles, right? I guess he originally built it. I don't really know, but that's the only reason I can think of they would name the mansion after him. So one day in 2011, I guess I should add, because it's kind of an important year, Jonah approaches Rebecca and says, look, we've been dating, we get along really great, I want you to move in with me. And that kind of takes her by surprise. She loves him a lot, like, they get along really well, and she wants to be with him. But she likes being her own woman, you know, she likes having her own job, she likes having her own place, she likes being able to rely on herself. And if she agreed to move in with Jonah, she would kind of tacitly be agreeing to become a kept woman. Yeah, you know, he wanted her to be around the house, help kind of serve as a babysitter for his son. And, you know, she was really, if she found it really awkward to say yes to such an arrangement without a ring on her finger. And so she really pushed the angle of, well, I can, I guess, help support my parents. I can't do that. Jonah said, look, I have no problem, you know, helping your parents out. I'll pay whatever. I just want you to, you know, be there when I'm there. So she, like every good man, he wore her down until finally she just said yes. She quits her job, moves in with Jonah at Spreckles Mansion. And Jonah does, you know, support her parents. He's not a bad guy that we know of. So they're not left hung out to dry. Yeah, and, you know, since Rebecca's now living with Jonah, she kind of becomes like a de facto stepmom to little Max. And the two actually got along great. She was really good with kids. He really liked hanging out with her. She was teaching him art, and he loved it. They got along so well, though, that it kind of caused a rift between Jonah and his ex-wife, Dina. Because Dina kind of felt like Rebecca was replacing her, intentional or not. You know, and Max was kind of making it worse. Not on purpose, of course. He's 6 years old, but he liked spending time with Rebecca. There'd be times where it was time for him to go to his mom's house, and he wouldn't want to go because he and Rebecca were doing something fun. And Max was, you know, fiendishly stirring the pot, I guess you could say. No, we're not going to say that about him. He's just a kid. I'm just trying to create artificial tension. I don't know why, because now we can get some real tension. So July 11th, 2011, Rebecca's at her new home now, watching Max and Zena, her teenage sister who had come to visit. Rebecca's in the downstairs bathroom while Max is playing upstairs. Never got it specifically, but I think Zena was upstairs as well in one of the bedrooms. While Rebecca's in that bathroom downstairs, she hears just an awful noise. A scream, a crash, and then a thud. She raced out and found just an awful sight. Max was laying in the middle of the foyer. The chandelier was in pieces around him, and his razor scooter was near his little body. Rebecca noticed he was badly injured, wasn't breathing, and so she immediately began CPR. And in the process of doing so, she yelled for Zena to call 911 to get the paramedics there. When paramedics arrived, they found Rebecca was still performing CPR. They kind of took over the scene. The police officers that accompanied them pulled Rebecca to the side and, you know, like you would do, start asking questions. Hey, what happened here? What do we need to know? That sort of thing. And Rebecca was in such a state that she really had a hard time answering the officer's questions. She kind of was able to give them a picture of what occurred in bits and pieces from all these broken perspectives she was apparently going through. She didn't really offer a lot of interesting information, because she hadn't seen what had happened, of course. But while she was giving CPR, she did say that Max whispered the name Ocean. And I say name because that was the name of their dog. So needless to say, Max was severely, severely injured in the fall. Doctors would soon discover that he had apparently landed on his neck when he hit, and it damaged his spinal cord to such a degree that his body was not receiving signals from his brain to breathe or to circulate blood. And really that, you know, had Rebecca not begun CPR so quickly, Max would have been dead before the emergency personnel could have gotten there. Rather than feeling like a hero, though, you know, Rebecca's overcome with grief. She feels responsible. She was the adult home with Max. She should have been watching him. And, you know, of course, Dina is losing her mind. She's so angry about what happened. Totally understandable in that situation. She's blaming Rebecca. Meanwhile, Jonah's furiously arguing with Dina, saying, "The doctor just told us if she hadn't started CPR, he would have died. She did everything she could. Because of her, little Max is still alive and has a fighting chance now, you know?" But, you know, you expect all this, right? This is a horrible situation. Very stressful. Lots of anger. Lots of feelings of helplessness. And, you know, Max was in such bad shape, they had to put the little guy in a medically induced coma. And, you know, doctors were telling the parents initially that, you know, this fall could cause some pretty significant brain damage in Max. You know, we have to wait and see how things go, but y'all need to prepare yourselves for that. Now, pursuant to all reasonable procedures, the police did do a short investigation just to make sure there was no signs of foul play or anything suspicious, but they couldn't find anything. They just chalked this up to what it seemed to be, an accident. Rebecca felt really jammed into a corner. She wanted to go and be with Max and hold his hand because, of course, she loved him. But she also felt like she had no business being around there. Number one, you know, Dina would be a little hostile to be around, of course. And number two, she felt a lot of guilt over this. She was saying this was her fault, that if it wasn't for her, Max wouldn't have fallen and all that stuff. Now, of course, Jonah and Dina are practically living at the hospital with Max. So Rebecca kind of decides she's going to take on the caretaker of the home role in earnest. So Jonah's calling her to have, you know, to ask her to help do things. And she's running errands and things like that, in part to keep her mind off of the tragedy, in part to help out the family during this time. The day after Max falls and all this excitement, Rebecca has to go to the airport because it's time, you know, her sister needs to get out of the situation. She's a young teenager. She doesn't need to be caught in the middle of this. So she's going to fly back to Missouri. Likewise, Jonah's brother, Adam, is flying into town to support his brother at this time and his nephew. Adam's from Memphis, Tennessee, and is a tugboat captain of all things. So Rebecca goes to the airport, drops off her sister, picks up Adam, brings him back home. Adam takes up residence in the mansion's guest house. That night, Rebecca speaks to her oldest sister, Mary, and really just kind of pours out a lot of her feelings, how upset she was over the entire situation, how much guilt she was feeling. She, you know, of course, also worried that Dina's so mad at her, you know, what if Jonah decides that it's just best for me to leave? Since I've quit my job, I've given up my, you know, where I was living, I don't have anywhere to go. I don't have my own money. And, you know, this was really freaking her out. Rebecca ends the call after not too long, because she says, you know, I really need to go to bed early because I do want to go see Max tomorrow. Dina's going to be gone in the morning, so I'm going to show up early and spend some time with them. Around midnight, doctors come and talk to Jonah and Dina, and they have some pretty terrible news. The damage to Max's brain was showing to be worse than they initially feared. And the doctors were of the opinion that for him to ever walk or even speak again would be a miracle. Jonah calls Rebecca with this information. Again, this is just after midnight, but he only catches her voicemail and he leaves a message passing along what the doctor told him. Rebecca apparently checks her voicemail shortly before 1 a.m. And sadly, 3 days later, on July 16th, doctors declare Max brain dead. And his parents, you know, have to make the toughest choice of their lives at that point in time. Now, let's jump back a few days, back to the 13th of July. Adam wakes up in the guest house early that morning. This is the day after he's arrived. And, you know, is poking around, and guest house isn't very well stocked, so he's going to go to the main house to make himself a cup of coffee. As he's walking across the yard to get to the kitchen, he sees an awful sight of his own. Rebecca is hanging from the balcony of the guest room. Adam immediately calls 911 and reports Rebecca's death, or he reports the hanging, as he claims on the 911 call he didn't know if she was still alive or not. When police arrive, Adams cut down Rebecca and attempted CPR on her. Paramedics, you know, assess the situation and realize that not only is Rebecca dead, she's been dead for a few hours. Police, you know, now having been to this mansion for the second time in 3 days, decide that it's probably worth their time to do a more thorough search to make sure they're not missing anything. Again, totally makes sense. And I think the fact of how Rebecca was found really forced them to do an extensive search, because Rebecca was found, if you listen to Adam's story, she was found hanging from this balcony, and she was totally nude. She had her ankles bound and her wrists bound behind her back, and she had a blue shirt that had been tied around her face. And the sleeves had been knotted up in some fashion and forced into her mouth as a gag. She had black drops of paint across her chest and breast, and some traces of blood on her inner thigh. When police, you know, they decided, of course, to start their search in the guest room, because that's where she was hanging from. And they get there and they see the rope coming in from outside, going over the railing of the balcony, and it's tied to the leg of the bed in the guest room. They also find just a variety of odd items in the room, okay? So there's two knives laying on the floor. One's like a steak knife, and the other is more of like a chef's knife or a kitchen knife, I would call it, on the floor. There's two artist paint brushes and a tube of black acrylic paint, likewise on the floor. A damp bath towel with a few drops of Rebecca's blood also on the floor. There was also two other really, really strange pieces of evidence they discovered. The first was a book of witchcraft that was on the bed, which was apparently open to a page that, I don't know the right way to describe this, which I guess it's like some sort of initiation ceremony for an apprentice witch and how they're bound. I don't know. But apparently the binding was very similar to how Rebecca was bound. The second piece of evidence that was of interest was on the guest bedroom door, in black acrylic paint, was painted what the police took as a suicide note. And it was short. All it said was, "She saved him, can you save her?" Just those seven words. "She saved him, can you save her?" Obviously, this being the scene of the death, the forensic experts focused all their time, effort, and attention on this room. And despite how thoroughly they searched, they only found evidence of Rebecca in the room. They only found her fingerprints. They only found her DNA. No one else could be found. Detectives, meanwhile, searched the rest of the house. They found the rope that Rebecca had used to apparently hang herself. It was a red nautical note. Apparently, it was used for... Jonah, of course, owned a boat, because I don't think you can be a millionaire in California without having a boat. And this rope was used for either tying the boat off at, you know, when they're docked, or when they go water skiing, things like that. It was stored in the garage with a bunch of other nautical items, so it didn't stand out. There's nothing unusual about it. They also found a few more drops of blood in the master bedroom. Now, the master bedroom, just to give you a lay of the land, again, this is a 27-room mansion, so it's impressive size, right? The master bedroom and bathroom were kind of at one corner, and this guest bedroom were at the other corner of how the house was built. And so it was a little bit of a trek to get from one end to the other. Now, naturally, because Adam's the only person on the scene, they bring him in to question him as a formality. They have to. There's no way they can say they're doing their job and not speak to Adam on the record, right? Well, Adam's totally cool with it. Like, he's gung-ho about helping the police. He, you know, doesn't ask for a lawyer, waives whatever rights, and even goes so far as to volunteer to take a polygraph test. And he tells his story as best he can, and then he goes through the polygraph test, but the results came back inconclusive. Now, remember what we've talked about in the past. The purpose of a polygraph test is not to find out who did it. It's a tool of exclusion. You try to eliminate somebody as a suspect with a polygraph test. Well, Adam didn't do well enough that they could exclude him. However, the officer who was conducting the test ultimately dismissed the results on the basis that the event clearly had been so emotional for Adam that it was impossible for them to obtain reliable results at this time, because his emotions were just so up and down that there was no good baseline they could operate off of. Adam's, of course, disappointed at this result, but he's comforted by the officer saying, "We get it. We understand. It's not a big deal. You're free to go." And so rather than just walking out of the station like he probably should have done, Adam decides to volunteer one bit of information that struck everybody as odd. And he said, you know, "Look, one detail I left out was before I went to go look for coffee, after I first woke up in the morning, I pleasured myself." And then he left. Why he felt that was so important to disclose, don't know. But it kind of surprised everybody. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, Jonah receives a phone call while he's at the hospital watching his son slowly die, that his girlfriend has been found dead. He's, of course, in total shock. I mean, this poor guy's been through an emotional roller coaster already with his son. Now he gets this bomb dropped on him. His ex-wife, Dina's still there, and he just goes white when he gets off the phone. She's like, "What's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong?" And he responds in a very odd manner. He's kind of unable to speak at first, so he mimics taking a knife, sticking it in your belly, and kind of disemboweling himself. And Dina kind of looks at him like, "What are you talking about?" And he said that Rebecca's dead. She killed herself due to her sense of Asian honor, whatever that is supposed to mean. But that's how Jonah explains it to Dina. Police are given Rebecca's phone, given the code to it so they can poke around in there. Because, of course, her family, you know, wants the police to keep investigating. They refuse to believe that she could have killed herself. But when the police go through the phone, they find all these text messages that show how unhappy Rebecca really was. I mean, she was telling people she's crying all the time. She felt like she had no worth, that she wasn't contributing anything to society, that she couldn't do anything with her life, that all the money wasn't worth this. You know, she didn't like being expected to be a homemaker, and that this life may not be for her. Police also see that the last call Rebecca made from her phone was to her voicemail, where presumably she learned about Max's failing condition. Again, that was around 1 a.m. as we discussed earlier. All right, so we've got two deaths effectively within 3 days of each other at the same house, both under unusual circumstances and in a very wealthy part of town, right? So the press naturally goes bananas. This is all they can talk about, all they can write about. This kind of forces the sheriff's office into action. They take charge of the investigation and spend several weeks carefully reviewing the evidence before they reach any sort of official conclusion. Now, strangely, when I don't know who, at what point exactly the sheriff's office was brought in to oversee this investigation, but the local law enforcement initially decided to leave Rebecca's naked body on the grass outside of the house, uncovered, basically letting everybody in the free world see her naked. And Mary, Rebecca's oldest sister, kind of loses her mind about this. You know, she just finds it totally and completely disrespectful. When the sheriff's office is on the scene, they ask for assistance from a rather unusual source. They call in the retired district attorney of San Diego County to serve as an advisor as they conduct their investigation. They don't call on the current DA. They call on the former DA. And no one's explained why. Not only was this dude just serving as an advisor, but he was actually allowed into the house. He was allowed to inspect things. In fact, it wasn't until he left the house that police finally covered up Rebecca's body and packed it up in an ambulance to be taken for an autopsy. At the initial press conference the sheriff's office holds a day or two later, you know, the sheriff does this thing, we're going to do all that we can do, we've got our best men on it, we're, you know, blah, blah, blah. Everything you would want to hear from a sheriff. But he made it clear, too, that, you know, at this time, we don't have any evidence that convinces us this is a criminal act. So nobody needs to be worried. It's not like somebody broke into this mansion and was killing people. We've just got what appears to be at this time. And again, this was very, very, very early on, right? At this time, it looks like this is just two tragic accidents kind of back to back. And it kind of cracked me up because when he made the statement, a reporter immediately raised her hand and she said, you know, can you repeat that? And he says, yeah, you know, we don't consider these at this time to be criminal acts. And she said, you found a woman that's naked, bound, with her hands tied behind her back. There's knives on the scene. What more do you need to consider this a criminal issue? What, you know, what would it take for you to consider her death to have some criminal element in place? And of course, the question's not really answered. Jonah, meanwhile, after dealing, you know, with the death of his son, the death of his girlfriend, which again just has to be an atrocious feeling, but he's also the CEO of this company. And when the news of his son's death comes out, the stock price of his company starts falling. So he does what he feels like is necessary to protect his business. He hires an outside PR team. Then he also hires armed bodyguards, but just for himself. And he hires an attorney for his brother, who by this time has already returned back to Memphis. Now, of course, the PR, that's accepted by reporters. Nobody questions that. But Jonah wouldn't talk about why he felt like he needed bodyguards or why he felt the need to hire an attorney for his brother. The sheriff's office worked on this case for about 7 weeks and held a big gala of a press conference to announce their findings, and it was kind of a spectacle. They started off discussing Max, and they said, you know, as to Max, it was law enforcement's belief that Max was playing on his scooter upstairs, maybe got going too fast, went over the banister, crashed through the chandelier, and it was the impact of the fall that caused his death. So they were ruling his death accidental. They didn't see any signs suggesting foul play or that he had been injured beforehand or anything like that. Pretty straightforward. As to Rebecca's case, law enforcement determined that her manner of death was suicide. They claim they found no evidence that, you know, anybody was in the guest room, much less the house. She was there alone. And as far as her being bound up in the way she was, they said, you know, we've determined that this is something she could have done herself. In fact, they had an officer who is roughly the same height and weight as Rebecca, bind herself on a video. They had this prepared. I guess they knew because they were going to get hammered with questions about it. And they showed this to reporters, you know, of her binding herself behind her back and all that stuff. Now, the police did admit that, you know, they didn't want to mess with the bindings, obviously, because that's evidence in case there was something criminal that they learned of later. So they just copied the bindings as best they could. What the officer did on the video was not a perfect match for what Rebecca had allegedly done to herself. But they felt it was important to show everybody that regardless of how you tied the knots, it was possible. The immediate reaction from both families, and by that I mean, you know, Dina and her family, as well as Rebecca's family, was, this is all BS. None of them believed anything the sheriff was saying. They knew that law enforcement got it wrong. Dina was of the mind that Rebecca had done something to cause Max's injuries and subsequent death, so she ended up hiring a forensic pathologist, an independent one, to review all the evidence of the case. And the pathologist determined that several of the police's conclusions were flawed, and you'd have to overlook or just flat out ignore some of the evidence to reach some of the conclusions the police did. For example, she found from the medical examiner's report that Max had suffered some blows to his head and face that were not consistent with injuries you would receive in a fall. She also learned that it was impossible for the scooter to work on the carpet they had on the second floor. They had very thick, luxurious carpet. If you've ever seen a Razor scooter, you know, it sits very low to the ground. So she said, you just couldn't get it, you know, their idea that he was going too fast doesn't work here. She did find, too, that the forensics report indicated the scooter had paint markings on both the wheels and its undercarriage, which matched the paint that was used on the banister. Fourth, she says, based on the injuries Max suffered, he would have been unable to speak, even whisper, in any way whatsoever, which implicitly suggests Rebecca was untruthful when she told police that Max had whispered his dog's name. Even if Max was on his scooter, this pathologist determined that the banister was much higher than he was, and he couldn't have just accidentally fallen over. There had to be, he would have had to climb up over it, or somebody would have had to pick him up. So the fall could not be accidental. But accidental as in walking down the hallway and he just trips over. I guess if you've had a 6-year-old, you know they're just like feral cats and will get into everything. So could he have climbed up over the banister? Sure, I that wouldn't shock me in the least. And I guess you can consider that an accidental, but the pathologist decided, in her mind, that what made the most sense from all the evidence she had been presented with and she was aware of, and based largely on what appeared to be Rebecca's state of mind, that there was some sort of altercation on the second floor near this banister. And it was, in her mind, Rebecca was probably trying to discipline Max in some way. She picked up Max because he was being uncooperative. Max was squirming and all that, slipped from her hands, and then fell over the banister down to the floor below. Needless to say, this report really, really fired up both Rebecca's family and Dina's family. And the person that affected the most had to have been Rebecca's older sister, Mary, because she responded by launching her own investigation. Now, the investigation Mary funded is much more widely reported because it's much more interesting. So it's getting its own segment. Mary's first step was to hire an attorney just to assist her. This was not a trial attorney, not a criminal attorney, not, you know, nothing like that. She just wanted someone who was familiar with the area, because again, the rest of Rebecca's family lived in Missouri, and this is all taking place just outside of San Diego, California. So she hires an attorney just to help her navigate things in the world of California. And so this attorney says, well, look, the first thing we need to do is hire our own forensic pathologist to do another review of the case from, you know, their perspective, or I'm sure was presented as a more objective perspective. So they hire a very famous pathologist themselves, and this dude finds several oddities too. First, while it was true that Rebecca's fingerprints were found in the guest room, they were not found in places where a person would generally put their hands in this type of scene. For example, there's that suicide note, the police are calling it, that's painted on the door. Rebecca's fingerprints aren't on that door at all. There's also none of her fingerprints on the bed where the rope was tied. There's no fingerprints on the rope. In fact, it appeared to this expert that it was very likely portions of the scene had been cleaned before police arrived. He also was confounded by the idea that Rebecca would be able to hang herself in the bound condition she was in. Again, the balcony had a railing going around it that was a little high. Rebecca was only 5'2", and unless she had a step stool or a chair, something like that to climb on, she wouldn't really be able to get up over the railing to hang herself, particularly with her ankles bound together. Further, the pathologist said, you know, he had been doing this for decades, and never once in his career had he personally seen or had he ever heard of a woman committing suicide by hanging in a naked state. So that stuck out. That really stood out to him a lot. At the pathologist's request, Mary paid to have Rebecca's body exhumed so it could undergo a second autopsy. And this second autopsy found injuries that were not reported in the medical examiner's report. The pathologist found that Rebecca had suffered at least 4 severe blows to the back of her head and neck before she died. But when you inspect the area of her death where she's hanging, under that balcony, there's nothing there. Considering the length of the rope and all that stuff, there was nothing for her to hit her head on. She would just swing freely. So that stood out, as it should. He also noticed that Rebecca's neck did not show injuries to the thyroid cartilage, which is a traditional hallmark of a death by hanging. But Rebecca did show injuries to the hyoid bone in a manner that is the traditional hallmark of a death by strangulation. There was also possible but inconclusive evidence that Rebecca may have been sexually abused before she was killed. Finally, it was determined that the blood found on the carpet and in the master bath was likely to be menstrual blood from Rebecca. So Mary's attorney, you know, takes all this new evidence, goes to the sheriff's department and says, "We found all this. Y'all really need to look at this again." And she was told, "Nope, not gonna happen. We ain't interested." And she said, "You understand what you're dealing with here, right? If y'all don't open up this investigation again, the only route we have is to file some sort of civil action, and we're going to release all this information during the course of the trial, and it's gonna make y'all look like a bunch of fools." So they take it up the chain of command, comes back down, detectives say, "Nope, sorry. You do what you need to do. We're not reopening the case." So at the advice of the first attorney, a second attorney is hired to represent Rebecca's estate, essentially. to file a wrongful death action. The suit was filed in 2013 against Adam Shaknai, Dina Shaknai, and her twin sister, Nina. Because these were the only three people who had access to the house the night Rebecca died, who also couldn't provide any evidence of an alibi to this attorney. However, Dina and Nina were eventually dismissed from the case as security footage from the hospital clearly showed Dina was with her son all night the night Rebecca died, and Nina ended up having several alibi witnesses who made it pretty clear that she was not at the scene when Rebecca died. What happened when this information came up, the attorney representing Rebecca's estate pulled off kind of a dramatic and humbling move, in my opinion. He held a press conference with Mary and the rest of Rebecca's family on one side, and Dina and Nina and their family on the other side of the table. And he basically said to the public, or to the press that was there, look, we have learned that Dina and Nina could not possibly be involved with this. And we just want to apologize for naming them as defendants. We did this because we could not find a way to eliminate them as defendants until we came across these pieces of evidence. Once we found him, we wanted to kick him out as quickly as possible. All that. And, you know, that's virtually unheard of. So, I mean, this is a very classy move, even though it was probably very humbling for him. And it was at this press conference that, interestingly, Dina first publicly acknowledged that she wasn't on board with the idea that Rebecca was behind Max's death anymore. Two of the three defendants in this lawsuit go away. All we have left is Adam, Jonah's brother, right? Well, this case eventually has to go to trial. So, and that happens in March of 2018. And the scene in the courtroom was what you would expect to see in some sort of John Grisham novel adapted for a movie or a drama series or something, because you walk in and you see, you know, the defense sitting on one side of the room, and it's Adam at the center with literally just surrounded by all these great lawyers that are probably charging thousands of dollars per hour to represent him. Then on the other side of the aisle, you've got one attorney and Mary and nobody else sitting there. And the team that Jonah had hired for Adam was so prestigious that the lead counsel, who was a former U.S. attorney, President Trump tried to hire him away from this case right before trial started to work on a matter for the president. But the attorney said, I'm sorry, I'm already obligated to do this. And President Trump had to find somebody else. Now, I will say that the attorney representing Rebecca, technically that's not a correct phrase, but it's the easiest way to understand what's going on here. The attorney representing Rebecca really, really did a masterful job in this case. Now, the defense has every advantage in this situation, right? I mean, Adam's only there a couple days. The police investigated him and cleared him. The police said Rebecca killed herself. There's no physical evidence that's ever been found putting anybody else inside the house the night Rebecca died. So it's a heck of an uphill battle for Rebecca's attorney to fight through. But this dude sliced through each and every argument like he was some sort of ninja superhero in a Marvel movie, okay? So he's got all that evidence we've talked about before that the first attorney hired, from the pathologist, the first attorney hired. This attorney hires a second forensic expert who also testifies. And she kind of gets into questioning how the sheriff's office conducted its investigation of the guest room. Because she said, you know, again, every place there should have been fingerprints, there's not. And she notes, you don't even find her fingerprints on the doorknob. Her fingerprints are in very weird places. Police said there was no fingerprints on the knives. She said that was not true, that on the chef's knife, Rebecca's fingerprints could be found, but only on the blade. And they were in such a position that the only way the prints could leave the prints, or let's say this in a way that makes sense. The only way Rebecca's fingers could leave the prints in the shape and manner that they were found was if she was holding the knife by the blade behind her back and probably in some sort of elevated state. Or in other words, her hands were tied up and she couldn't just let them loosely fall. So from that, it was hypothesized that Rebecca had gotten a hold of the knife and was using it in an effort to cut herself free from her bondage. As to the steak knife, it did not have prints on it, but it did have Rebecca's blood on the handle, not on the blade. And all things considered, there was a rather significant amount of blood on the handle, such that it had kind of seeped down into the recesses of the wood on the handle. But, as we noted earlier, Rebecca's hands, her arms, her torso, her feet, you know, everything's free of blood except for that one little spot on her inner thigh. And the expert believed that the blood that was found on the inner thigh was consistent with the blood from the knife handle being drug across her inner thigh. So this pathologist suggested that it was possible Rebecca was sexually assaulted in part with the handle of the steak knife. Next, they talked about the knots on the rope. And testimony was presented by experts that the knots used to bind Rebecca were consistent with the types of knots used to secure ships when docked. Apparently, there was this very unique hitch that was added to the knot, which you typically saw or you typically see on ropes that are holding large ships in port. And again, as a reminder, Adam was a tugboat captain. A handwriting expert also testified, and he said, you know, everything about the suicide note is wrong. First of all, Rebecca's known handwriting that they had retrieved from, you know, had signing checks, signing documents, other basically any sort of official document that they could get their hands on that she had dealt with, they used for analysis here. And the expert said, when Rebecca wrote, her writing always slanted to the right. But the painted suicide note was written in such a way that all the letters slanted to the left. There was also a very unusual and unique, for lack of a better term, I'm going to call flourish on the end of all of the letter M's in the note. Essentially, whoever would write it would, the left side of the M would have a short leg, the right side of the M would be much longer and would end on some sort of curve or circle or something, you know, different. Rebecca, there was no evidence of her signing M's or making M's in that fashion. She had very square M's. They weren't, you know, the two legs were the same length. Certainly didn't have the little flourish on it. Also, where the suicide note was placed suggested that it was painted by somebody who stood approximately 5'11". And again, Rebecca was 5'2". So she would have been riding much higher than she's used to. and there's no good reason why she would need to do that. However, when you look at Adam, his handwriting slants in the same direction as a suicide note. When he signs his name, all his M's have the short left side and the longer right side with the little flourish on it. And Adam stood at 5'10". So right, almost perfectly in line with the expert's testimony. Finally, a neighbor was brought in to testify. She lived two or three houses down from the Spreckles mansion. And she said, the night of Rebecca's death, I heard a woman screaming in a very panicked way. And she said, the voice sounded like it came from a young adult woman, not a teenager, not an elderly person. And she heard the screaming maybe around midnight. She wasn't certain on the time, but she thought it was just before midnight. When she was asked by the defense counsel, why did you never go to the police with this information? She said, oh, I did, but they weren't interested in talking to me. They wouldn't take any reports from me. They just dismissed me from the scene. And she said, actually, when I heard about this lawsuit being filed, I contacted this attorney and told him I heard this and he was interested in talking to me. Now, the defense obviously did a bang-up job representing Adam because he's got this team of incredible attorneys. And their mantra throughout the entire trial was, show me some evidence that Adam was in the room. You couldn't do it, they said. There's no evidence Adam was in the room. There's no evidence Adam was in that house. There's no evidence Adam ever touched Rebecca until he tried to perform CPR on her the morning after she died. And, you know, they tried to poke holes in a lot of the plaintiff's theories here. They, particularly the handwriting expert, they really went hard after him. They made a big deal over the fact that, you know, you haven't reviewed this handwriting versus the world. You've worked in this limited universe of, is it Rebecca's or is it Adam's? And they got him to admit that absolutely this could be somebody else's handwriting outside of Rebecca's or Adam's. He said he just noted that the similarities between what was on the door were consistent with Adam's typical handwriting. On the forensic expert that testified, particularly about the blood on the handle of the steak knife. They had her admit that the blood that was found on Rebecca's inner thigh was not necessarily from the steak knife. It very easily could have been just a drop of menstrual blood that had trailed down her thigh for a spill. And the knot expert, when he was cross-examined, he said, I have no clue how much knowledge Rebecca had about knots. You know, could she have tied this? If she was good with knots, absolutely she could have. And then they, when, you know, it's the defense turn to put on their evidence, they start calling witnesses. And the first one they called was Jonah, who's been very quiet during all of this. He's apparently been advised, just keep your head down, stay out of it. So this really is the first time the public is hearing from Jonah in any meaningful way about this lawsuit and about Rebecca's death. And of course, he comes across with a lot of charisma because he's used to being a leader and holding these meetings and being in tight situations where he's got to talk his way out of problems, as you would do as a business leader. It's part of, you know, making your business grow and solving problems. So he's very charismatic. He's also extremely sympathetic because of everything he's been through all this. So the reporters that were there noted that he was really a very good witness throughout most of his testimony. And, you know, he said that Rebecca did have some knowledge of how to tie nautical knots because they would go out boating. Now, he said it happened virtually every weekend. And when they would go boating, you know, they'd do various things and sometimes they'd need to stop at places, and when they would, he would normally kind of park the boat and Rebecca would jump out and tie off the boat. And he said, you know, I taught her how to do it. She was very good at it. So could she have tied this knot? In my mind, yes. Well, the defense, or the prosecution, was kind of ready for this. And they actually had brought with them a 2x4 with the, I don't know the proper name for it, but the little metal instrument that's used to hold boats in place that you tie off onto. And it, you know, it was probably 12 or 16 inches long. It wasn't huge. And he takes up to the witness stand, the attorney does. He says, okay, you know, Jonah, can you demonstrate the knots you taught Rebecca to tie? And he did. And, you know, they were typically this figure eight style and whatnot. But what the attorney noted was, in all the knots that Jonah demonstrated to the jury, not a single one of them had that hitch in it. And that hitch was key because that's what would hold a large boat. You don't need it for the smaller, you know, for a personal recreational type boat. But, you know, when you've got a cargo ship, you better make sure you've got that thing secured in place. So you had to add that extra hitch on there for the security of knowing that the rope wouldn't fail. Eventually, Adam was forced to take the stand. And as good as his brother was as a witness, Adam was as bad as a witness. Reporters who had been following the story had just constantly gotten rumors or constantly had people tell him off the record that Adam was a really weird guy. And when he was on the stand, some of that came out. Just not in his testimony per se, but in his mannerisms. He was clearly uncomfortable. He couldn't sit still. He was moving. I mean, it was like having a four-year-old trying to have them sit still in a chair for an hour, you know? It's just impossible for them to sit there. They have to fidget with something, and that's what he was doing. When he was asked on cross-examination about the morning he found Rebecca, he remembered nothing. He couldn't remember, you know, how high off the ground her body was. He said he remembered, you know, having to get like a... He drug over a table to climb up on to cut her down, but he couldn't remember which table he had used. He, you know, couldn't remember how long he had given CPR for, anything like that. Basically, if Rebecca's attorney asked a question, his response was, I don't know or I don't recall. Rebecca's attorney, again, in a very smart move, played the actual 911 call for the jury while Adam was on the stand. During the call, he tells the 911 operator, there's a woman that's hanging from the window. It looks like she tried to hang herself. You know, please come. And during the whole conversation, he keeps re-saying, a woman, a woman, a woman, a woman. And the attorney said, you know who she was? Why didn't you call her Rebecca? And Adam couldn't provide an answer. So he said, well, even in the heat of the moment, I have understanding you've just met this woman. Maybe you forgot her name, okay? But why didn't you say it was your brother's girlfriend? Adam couldn't answer. He couldn't defend any of the actions he took, why he took them, what he did. In fact, and this came after the trial, but it was determined that by experts who continued to look into this case, Rebecca's body was so low to the ground that Adam would not have needed to stand up on anything. He would have just needed a knife to cut her down. During closing arguments, Rebecca's attorney made this drastic and dramatic decision that I wouldn't have done. But he did it, and it apparently worked beautifully, so hats off to him. He had a mannequin prepared that were in the same proportions as Rebecca. He had it mounted on a pole, bound just how Rebecca was, and he wheeled that sucker in front of the jury so it was staring them in the face the entire time he gave his closing argument. And he gave, during his closing argument, he gave his theory about what happened to Rebecca. And his theory was basically she was taking a shower when, and she got out and she was drying off and all that, when something made her walk across the entire mansion to the guest room. Be it an odd sound, be it somebody forcing her, we don't know. But his theory was when she arrived in the guest bedroom, Adam snuck up behind her or surprised her and struck her on the head with a blunt object multiple times, making sure that she was either knocked out or dead. He then tied her up, sexually assaulted her, and in the process of assaulting her, apparently the theory is he left the chef's knife on... The theory was he left the chef's knife on the bed. That makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? And that's when Rebecca grabbed it, because she came to during the assault in this theory. She felt the knife, she grabbed it, and she was trying to use it to cut her wrist free. Apparently, she was being manhandled too severely, and she was not successful, and when she was pulled to her feet, she dropped the knife. And that's probably when Adam got very angry about this and choked her out, killing her. It was highlighted that the suicide note said, "She saved him. Can you save her?" Which the attorney deciphered as the first part, "She saved him," clearly meant Rebecca saved Max. He could not explain, "Can you save her?" what that would mean. But he was convinced that Adam was angry about his nephew being injured, blamed Rebecca, and that's why he did this. Defense counsel, in their closing, stuck to the script. Again, show me any evidence that Adam was ever in that bedroom. Show me any evidence that Adam was ever near the master bedroom. Show me any evidence that Adam was in the house that night. They said, you can't do it. You cannot do it. There's no evidence here, and you cannot find Adam at fault for Rebecca's death. The case was given to the jury. This was obviously a very complicated case. Lots of moving parts. And so most legal experts at this time were expecting the jury to take days to resolve this, maybe even weeks. The jury reached a verdict in 3 hours. I mean, that is incredibly fast. Even in simple cases I've had tried that go to a jury, 3 hours is not a lot of time. The jury ultimately decided that Adam was civilly responsible for Rebecca's death and awarded Rebecca's family $5 million in damages for the wrongful death. Now again, this was a civil suit. It was not a criminal prosecution, so there was never a risk that Adam was going to jail. The whole idea behind this, from Mary's perspective and her team's perspective, was if we can get a jury to say Adam is civilly responsible, that has to spur the police into reviewing this case again. Now, after the verdict's announced and all that mess, Adam's confronted by the press outside, and he comes across as a very petulant little boy. He calls Rebecca's family a bunch of posers who had to blame Rebecca's death on someone, and they just got lucky in trial. He appealed the decision, but ultimately his attorneys and Mary's attorney worked out a deal where he would only have to pay a fraction of what the actual verdict was. If I recall correctly, it was only around 10%, maybe less, of what the jury had awarded. And after the news of the settlement was released, of course, reporters go and talk to everybody, and Adam was quoted responding to a reporter's question asking if he had killed Rebecca by stating, and I'm quoting here, "Hell, expletive no, I wouldn't expletive waste my time killing Rebecca Zahu." Having done all this work and gathered all this evidence and had all these experts testify, the attorneys take everything over to the sheriff's office again and say, "Okay, punks, we've done all your work for you. There is clearly something criminal about this death. Look at it again." Police refused to. They allegedly did reinspect their case files based on the jury's verdict in the civil case. Some people are suspicious as to whether or not that ever truly occurred, but they said, nope, suicide. Now, this has bothered Rebecca's family a lot because her parents are extremely Christian, very faithful in their beliefs. They raise their daughters to go to church every Sunday, and it appears that the daughters followed in this tradition. And so they're very bothered with the idea, you know, suicide is a sin, and officially, for all time, apparently, it's going to show that our daughter died as a sinner in their eyes. For what it's worth, Dina continued her investigation after this trial in the hopes of being able to find some way to shed more light on Max's death, because she's so unimpressed with how the police conducted their investigation. Rebecca's family has filed suit against the sheriff seeking copies of the investigation records. In general, I can't speak to California law, of course, but in general, and I'm trying real hard here to record, and one of my dogs is just insistent on showing up on this podcast, so I apologize if there's some barking in the background. But again, Rebecca's family sued the sheriff seeking copies of the investigation reports, which in a non-pending matter, particularly a non-pending, non-criminal case, should, at least under Alabama law, be very easy to obtain. Again, I don't know California's law on this stuff, but the sheriff has put up a fight, a bloody fight, and has absolutely refused to turn them over. There have been hearings as recently as December of last year on this issue, and it appears so far that Rebecca's family has been winning most of the minor battles. We'll see if they end up winning the war. It's also worth noting that the sheriff has indicated he is retiring. He is not running for re-election again. So this issue may resolve itself if a new sheriff is elected in 2022, as he or she may just hand over the records and end the lawsuit. One interesting little note I found that I just want to share, even though I don't think it means anything. The bed that Rebecca hung from was, the entire mansion was remodeled and put up for sale after this event. And in the course of doing so, a lot of the furniture was disposed of. And apparently it was done in a manner where Jonah said, "Do whatever you want with the furniture. I don't want it. I've taken out everything I need, everything that's left behind. You can throw it away. You can keep it. You can sell it. You can give it to your men. I don't care. I just don't want it." Well, somehow that bed that held the rope that Rebecca held, was hanging from, came into the possession of a private investigator there in California. And he decided to call up a psychic he knew to come inspect the bed. And the psychic claimed that as soon as he touched the leg where the rope was tied to, he made immediate contact with Rebecca, who claimed she was murdered. He also made contact with Max, who said he was very happy and was having lots of fun with Rebecca. I'm sure the parents love hearing that. And that's that. We'll just go ahead and shut this one down and wait, you guys want my thoughts and opinion? Really? I don't know what to say. I'm so flattered. Okay. Well, I've got several. I feel compelled to share one fact I learned during my research that seems to be overlooked in a lot of reports on this case. Rebecca actually has a criminal record. She was arrested after trying to steal about $1,000 worth of jewelry from a department store in 2009, roughly right around the same time she began dating Jonah. On the flip side, Jonah has a bit of a history, although not official. He was accused in both of his divorces of being physically, verbally, and emotionally abusive with his ex-wives. From my experience as to the shoplifting, Rebecca's stealing jewelry that she doesn't need. There's no indication she's a materialistic person. And from what I understood, it's not like she was even trying to be sneaky. She was just grabbing things and throwing them in a shopping bag and tried to walk out and got caught. This could be a sign of a mental illness. I've had some clients who are your stereotypical paradigm of a WASP family. Dad, you know, works in the community. Everybody knows him and loves him. Mom volunteers in school. They have two good kids and all that. And then all of a sudden, mom gets arrested for stealing something stupid. And inevitably in those situations, it's determined that there's some mental illness that is affecting the defendant or is starting to fester and coming in and becoming an issue in the defendant's life. And this is how he or she is dealing with it. And I was happy to learn that I was not alone in that observation. A Google search confirmed to me that smart academic types have studied this and said that there is a direct link between people with no criminal record shoplifting and depression. And I've even included a link in our show notes to that article because I feel vindicated for once that I've got someone smarter than me saying that I'm right. That's so cool. Now, obviously, this isn't true across the board. Everybody who has depression is not a shoplifter. Everybody who's a shoplifter does not have depression. It's just a trend I had noticed, and it's a trend that these researchers have noticed. And it always comes across where everybody who knows the person says, how on earth did that happen? I even knew of an attorney who was, you know, young but growing, practice pretty successful for her age and all that. And she got arrested stealing a candy bar from a grocery store. And as an attorney, you know, anytime we have a brush with the law, it's a big deal because we have to send it to the ethics people and they investigate it. So we've got, you know, a criminal thing going on and then the ethical investigation going on. And it's a mess. Not that I've been through it personally, but it seems like it would be a mess. And it turns out that, you know, her parents instantly kind of like pulled her back home because they knew this wasn't right. They took her to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and she was examined and she was diagnosed as having both depression and some sort of eating disorder. And because of that, fortunately, they ended up dropping the charges against her, and she was able to move to a new part of town and kind of rebuild her reputation. And I think she's doing very well, very proud of her. All things considered, you know, that could be a career ender, and she managed to overcome it. So to me, when you've got Rebecca, who seems like she was struggling with this change, but again, this happened before she became, you know, the housewife she hated so much. I think this was our first indication that something was wrong in Rebecca's life. The fact that it coincides with Jonah coming into her world. to build up such a profitable business, you have to be a, in general, you are stereotypically a very strong type A personality. You're very aggressive. Maybe his aggression isn't limited to just the boardroom. We've got at least two ex-wives who said it falls into the bedroom too. So maybe she was a little intimidated by that, coupled with a budding new mental health issue, and that's why she was shoplifting. Now, when it comes to Max's death, I admit I have very limited opinions about it. My knee-jerk reaction, again, I've got three boys, one of them 6 years old. When I hear that he's laying at the bottom of the stairs, that the chandelier's been broken, and that his scooter's laying next to him, I honestly thought when I started doing this research, did that boy get up on the railing and try to scoot along it? Because I would totally expect my kids to try something stupid like that. Because in their minds, how cool would it be to ride your scooter down the banister, right? No idea if any of the findings would support my dad instinct on that one, but that's where I go. I'm not of the opinion that Rebecca directly caused Max's death. It strikes me really as a freak injury. I mean, for him to die, he had to land on his neck in that very specific way. And if you're going to want to hurt Max, I mean, six-year-olds are tough to fight, despite, you know, how small they are. And I'm not a 5'2" woman. You know, I'm a good bit taller and definitely a bit much more thick than she was. And it's exhausting to try to get my six-year-old whenever he's in a wrestling mood to do anything, you know? If it was some sort of intentional act, I just can't believe that she would be able to get him up and throw him over the top rope like that, particularly when her sister is in the house with them. Again, I believe Rebecca was suffering from some sort of developing mental illness, and I think we see that more so in her reaction to his death rather than in the death itself. It may have caused her, and I mean, I'm certainly not in a position to judge this, and I'm not saying this is the case, I'm just opining here. Perhaps her seemingly excessive guilt about the situation comes from her dealing with a flood of anxiety she's never had before. And, you know, depression really locks your mind down and makes it hard to think clearly. And so I'm totally fine putting a bow on Max's case and just letting it be. That being said, if Rebecca was involved, I wouldn't be, I guess, shocked. I would be surprised. There was nothing I found that indicated she was aggressive in her own right. But I, you know, I just don't lean in that direction. Now, I can really go on about Rebecca's death, and I will. It's just a doozy. There's no way around it. There's just so much to go through. I'll begin by saying I think it's very possible Rebecca could have been in the state of mind to kill herself with everything going on. But this is, I agree with that for that one pathologist, very odd way for a woman to kill herself. I've noticed throughout my career that women typically try to commit suicide in a way that's elegant, if that makes any sense. You know, if I were to describe what I believe to be kind of the stereotypical way that an average woman is going to kill herself, it's going to be something like she, you know, puts on her best nightgown, she puts on some makeup, she does her hair because she wants to look pretty. She takes a bottle of sleeping pills or some other sort of prescription medication, where in her mind, she'll just pass out and then she'll be found this beautiful sleeping beauty on the bed, you know. They don't take into account how much vomiting and other pains occur. So never ends up being quite a pretty scene. But that, again, I'm not an expert on this, but that's how, from my experience, I would describe what I would think a typical female suicide would be like. Hanging, that's a much more manly way to go out. And to hang oneself naked is certainly a very odd choice. And the nakedness sticks with me a lot. I've mentioned this in other episodes before, but if a body is found and it's been laid out in such a way as to preserve some modesty, particularly when the victim is female and the perpetrator is male, you can almost be certain that the person who killed that woman knew her and cared for her. I mean, that sounds stupid to say. You killed her, how could you care for her? But, you know, some men just reach that point with their wives where they're like, the only way out of this is for me to kill her. You know, she's the mother of my children. I loved her at one time. I don't want her to be embarrassed, but I gotta get rid of her. I can't. Look, don't make me explain it. That's just what I've seen. Meanwhile, those who have a grudge against the victim, again, a male perpetrator, female victim, a male with a grudge will typically leave the woman posed in such a way that her nakedness is obvious. They want to shame her a little bit more in death. And so that really, you know, the way Rebecca was found dead, naked and hanging outside, really seems like an effort to leave her with no dignity. And the entire nature of her death is so elaborate that it's suspicious, right? I mean, if you're doing what the police say and you're tying your own wrists together and your own ankles together and gagging yourself and all of this, that's going to take some time to prepare. And of course, there are people who decide, I'm going to kill myself when I get home from work today. They work the entire work day. You know, if it's a man, you know, maybe they wait to, they send their wife and kids off to go pick up dinner, and then he'll sit down in the bedroom and blow his brains out, you know? So he has that idea in his head all day, but it still comes down to a trigger pull, right? The preparation for death is very minor. This was very elaborate, and it's surprising, certainly possible, absolutely possible, but it's surprising that she would have the conviction to follow through with such an elaborate plan. A plan which would take, in my opinion, at least a couple hours to put all together. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm overestimating it, but I just can't imagine you could do this quickly. It doesn't make sense for her to want to tie herself up so thoroughly. Now, the police explain it away by saying she was so committed to dying that she wanted to make sure that none of her involuntary movements would jerk her loose. She wouldn't involuntarily scream out to alert the neighbors. She wanted to make certain that she would die. That is possible. I'm not buying it, particularly since she's throwing herself off into open air. There's nothing apparently that she could have touched or reached, kicked off of, bumped into, or the like underneath the balcony. And how do we make all of this jive with the autopsy, which indicated, and apparently undisputedly, that the hyoid bone was crushed, something that just would not happen during a hanging. It would happen during a strangulation. A violent strangling. And no one has explained or attempted to explain that I'm aware of how this would occur in Rebecca's death as explained by law enforcement. I just have to believe. I guess I would say I believe pretty strongly that she suffered that injury before she went over the balcony. And let's talk about the bindings coupled with that witchcraft book. Again, no one disputes the fact that Rebecca was a fairly faithful Christian. Meanwhile, you have Adam, who is considered an oddball in the family, right? So if I just tell you those two facts, and I say, we've got this book on witchcraft, whose do you think it is? I would think the majority of folks, and I may be wrong, would say, well, the odd dude, right? I mean, if he's into weird things, maybe that's one of them. This just seems, you know, if Rebecca's looking for answers, she may go to unusual places as she's dealing with this depression. Maybe. But would she go in the entirely opposite direction of the Bible? I don't know. Is it possible? Is it just maybe possible that, again, somebody wanted to discredit or dishonor or put another black mark on Rebecca's life by leaving this book in plain sight for police to find? And I just can't help myself here. Maybe it's tacky and I apologize, but the book was called something like Buckman's Guide to Witchcraft or Buckland's Guide to Witchcraft. And when I saw that, the first thing that popped into my head was, if your magic book isn't from Bunkman, it's bunk. I know, I should work in advertising. I could sell those puppies like hotcakes. The suicide note, such as it was, doesn't work for me either. Everything the handwriting analyst stated, I buy. I also think a woman is just not likely to deface a door with paint like that. And again, maybe I'm being stereotyping in some way. I acknowledge that, and I don't mean to if I am. But, you know, in my part of the world, if you go to a single man's house, it looks like a single man lives there, you know? It's, you'll have a bed, you'll have a couch, you'll have the TV and the electronics and the PlayStation and all that. It's not gonna have, you know, a live, laugh, love sign up on the wall or probably any sort of home decor type items outside of what like a 16-year-old boy would have. If you go to a woman's house, however, it's going to feel a lot more like a home. And so the idea that she would, and again, this is just me thinking out loud almost, the idea that she would ruin a door with her suicide note strikes me as odd, because I can't imagine it would be hard for her to grab pen and paper to write out her suicide note, particularly when she's spending all this time wrapping her ankles and her wrists in bindings. I also think the message itself is really, really odd in the way it is phrased. She saved him, can you save her? Why would Rebecca speak in third person? Why wouldn't the message make a lot more sense if it read, I saved him, can you save me? But then, why would she be asking someone to save her if she was that committed to suicide too, you know? She had, if you believe that narrative, she had reached the point in her life where she had made a decision to end her life. So what good does this note do? It doesn't pass on any information whatsoever. There's no apologies to her family. There's no apologies to God. There's no guilt in this message at all. You know, she's not apologizing for what happened to Max if she left this. Again, it's like almost like a taunt. On top of everything else, would she really feel like she saved Max if she had just received a phone call or a voicemail about Max's condition continuing to degrade? She saved Max so he could get to the hospital, but the little boy died, and with her training and all that, I would think she would know that the odds of him making a recovery once she learned the extent of his injuries would be pretty remote. So I that strikes me as some sort of mockery. I also am willing to take the position that law enforcement just wanted these cases closed. First, this is a very, very wealthy area where an unsolved murder would not be well tolerated by the locals. If the police could close the case as accidental or suicide, life is so much better for everybody involved. Additionally, they wouldn't have to report murders on their official crime statistics, which would probably have a negative effect both on the tourism market and on the real estate market, which nobody wants. I've mentioned it before. Cities, municipal, you know, any jurisdiction can manipulate those crime statistics reports. They turn over to the FBI or the Department of Justice or whoever it is that keeps it these days, based on what they need. You could very much overemphasize the amount of drug arrests you've made, and then you would be eligible for more federal funding to fight against, you know, to participate in the war on drugs that's been going and going and going and going. On the flip side, if you're trying to attract new businesses to your area, if you want the real estate market to pick up, then you kind of cut down on the number of violent crimes that get officially reported. We also don't really know and can't really appreciate how much influence Jonah would have had over this area. Again, we know that he owns the mansion in the area, and this is an area with lots of multi-million dollar mansions. He was easily a multi-millionaire. Some claimed he was actually a billionaire. You know that when people are running for election, he's one of the people that gets phone calls to ask for donations. And he probably is very generous with his donations. So if you're the mayor of this town or you're the sheriff here and a big donor comes to you and says, y'all need to close out these cases ASAP because not only is it hurting the community, it's killing my business. My stock is dropping like crazy and I won't be able to donate as much money next time y'all run for election. I've seen this crap happen with my own eyes. Not with someone as big and powerful as Jonah. Not out in San Diego, of course. But even with much smaller cases from much less wealthy people, I know this happens. I have seen it happen. To my benefit, to my client's benefit and to my client's detriment at different times. So I think that's a factor we have to keep in mind. Did Jonah throw some weight around here? Overall, what do I think? I almost totally am willing to accept the plaintiff's attorney's theory of the case. He did such a good job preparing that case for trial. He did such a good job collecting the right set of experts that I think I have to trust him. Adam arrives from Memphis to San Diego with some anger in his heart. His nephew has been hurt badly. He's hearing from the family that it's this Rebecca woman's fault, and he may be there to settle a score, you know? He takes a polygraph test, can't pass it, feels the need to talk about his sexual urges. As soon as he leaves San Diego for Memphis again, his brother hires him a criminal defense attorney. I don't know. There's just a lot of smoke there. A lot of smoke. Maybe there's some fire too. I don't know. We'll probably never know. But I'm willing to accept the plaintiff's attorney's theory on what happened. It makes sense to me. It's consistent with my experiences. I think Rebecca was murdered, and I just think the people that could make that determination have been given incentives to not make that determination. So, quite a tale, huh? If you are interested in this case and want to spend more time looking into it, You are in luck, as there are tons of resources available to you that you can delve and swim around in probably for weeks. And there's books, tons of news reports, YouTube videos, lots of other podcasts have covered this case. You can consume as much as you want. And there are as many opinions as there are sources out there. There will be detractors who are out there who certainly make a good argument, in my opinion, that the defense team was kind of right. There's no evidence Adam was in that room. And how could you feel that he's sophisticated enough to destroy all the evidence he was there while leaving all of this evidence that contradicts it being a suicide? So you can certainly explore a lot of those theories. I can't say that they're wrong. You know, I disagree personally. And if you, but you know, if you disagree with me and my thinking, then check out some of their thoughts. And you may come up with a theory that works better than mine. And if you do, I certainly would love to hear it. I'm not here to say I know everything. I'm just here to share cases with y'all because y'all keep listening. And I guess I'll keep doing it until there's no one left to talk to. All right, so we've got our palate cleanser. Not a huge fan of it. Hopefully y'all are. But, you know, we like to do themed ones, so we've got a California-themed joke, sort of. So here it goes. Did you hear about the California Owl Conspiracy Network? They're calling themselves the Cahoots. Cah, like the abbreviation for California, and then hoots, because that's what an owl does. It hoots. Like that. Okay. Thank you all for listening, even to that. We love you so much. You're really all we can think of at night. We're taking drugs to try to control it, but they're not working very well, and I haven't told the doctors. Please continue to, you know, share our show with everyone you love. That soothes our urges a little bit. Reviews are also awesome, particularly if they're good ones. As I've said before, if we're doing something wrong, please email me because I want to get better. We are back on Instagram, like I mentioned. Following us would be awesome. We aren't in the business of buying, you know, followers like a lot of other people are. So we'd rather have a natural organic growth to what we're doing here. Because I went to law school and I sold my soul because that's just, you know, part of what you do your first year. But I still have some pride in how we build this thing up. Again, don't forget to join our Facebook group before February. We haven't done a contest in a while, so you won't want to miss out. It'll be worth your while, I think. And you won't have to do much. I don't make y'all do much. I'm pretty easy going, aren't I? Anyway, I'm done. You guys stay warm. It's been really cold. We actually had snow here in Alabama, which never happens. Of course, if you live way down south, then you try to stay cool because I know you're dealing with some heat. And I really hope you will be well and you will join us for our next Tale of Woe, which should come out next week. Until then, all I really know to say is Brad out.
You survived another episode of Killing, Missing, Hidden, the podcast about bad things. Join us next time for another true and thrilling story.